Today on Maine Calling, organic farming pioneer Elliot Coleman on what organic really means, an encore presentation. Elliot Coleman has been growing vegetables using organic methods for more than 50 years. His first book, The New Organic Grower, came out in 1989 and is now in its third printing. It is considered a modern classic. Coleman lives with his wife, Barbara Damrosch, on their farm, Four Season Farm, in Harborside, Maine, on Penobscot Bay. And that is where he continually experiments and grows his knowledge of organic gardening practices. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we listen back to our earlier conversation with Elliot Coleman about his new book, The Self-Fed Farm and Garden. He shared his philosophy of permanent agriculture, and he discussed his frustration with much of the food labeled organic today. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by contributing listeners and support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Generations of organic farmers and gardeners have looked to Elliot Coleman for inspiration and practical advice. Coleman first came to national attention with the publication of his 1989 best-selling book, The New Organic Farmer. He joins us today to talk about his new book, out today, The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, its subtitle, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method. Elliot Coleman, an educator, organic farmer with Four Season Farm, and we are pleased to welcome him back to Maine Calling. Welcome, Elliot.
Thank you, Jennifer. A pleasure to be here.
Elliot, I read in your book that you are now officially retired from commercial farming and are now not a farmer, but a gardener.
I guess that's partially true. We did a fairly extensive search to find a young couple who would like to lease this farm. And we were just fortunate. These two people are doing a magnificent job. Our longtime customers are as happy as they've ever been. And the farm has continued to be in production, which is something I desperately wanted because of all the effort over the years it took to create this. So the fact that our retirement, I wouldn't say we're retired. I would say we're just temporarily sidelined.
Okay. And you are still focusing on experimenting, though, and improving methods. That's never going to stop, right?
Well, when we leased the farm, we leased all the greenhouses and the tractors with it. So I went and bought my own tractor so I could continue playing farm games out in the fields behind my house. And the driveway that comes into our house basically divides the farm in half. But see, the side we live on and the side that was always the commercial farm. And it was the side that was the commercial farm that has been leased out. So I have room to play farmer in the fields behind my house.
And what are you experimenting? You're experimenting with different green manures and seed saving?
Yes. And one of the interesting questions that I've been asked by a number of people is whether I could have created the soil fertility we have here with the same green manure system that I'm now maintaining it. And so we have two new recently cleared acres that we've never done anything with. And I'm running trials on them to see how many years of green manures it's going to take to bring those fields' fertility levels up to our standards.
And when we talk about green manure, what we mean is what my grandfather called cover crops, something that you plant in the off season to bring nutrients to the soil, correct?
I prefer to call them soil improving crops because that's probably what they do. Cover crops is another name for them. It depends on what you plan to do. If you plan to just protect the soil over winter and prevent winter rains from leaching nutrients out of it, then a cover crop is there to suck up those nutrients. It also just basically protects the soil by having roots in the ground when it isn't being used for vegetables.
I want to talk about methods some more, but first I want to talk about some bigger concepts, and I want to talk about the organic movement, which you've been such an important part of. People call you a pioneer, but you say that the concept of organic gardening is really quite old. Tell me about the thinkers, the people who started thinking about it and maybe even calling it organic gardening. Or growing or farming.
According to most opinion, there was an author in the 1940s who basically was the first one to use the words organic in his book. So the people you may have heard about, like Sir Albert Howard or Lady Eve Balfour, never used those terms, but they became popular in the US because J.I. Rodale, who started Organic Gardening magazine, used them as the name for his publication. And so if you read old books about England, it was called other names before that, but names that were suggesting that organic matter in the soil was important. And I find it amusing. I have a 1896 USDA Yearbook of Agriculture, 1896, and it has an article suggesting very clearly that the key to making agriculture work was to have plenty of organic matter in the soil. And they were as aware of that back then as organic farmers are today.
And in 1896, one of the many things I learned from your book, Elliot Coleman, is that this whole concept of commercial fertilizer, which I thought was a pretty new concept, is really started in the 1800s when people traveled the world looking for amendments for their soil.
Yes. Before there were factories turning out chemical fertilizers, people were looking for ways to add nutrients. And one of the first they found was on these rainless islands off the coast of Peru. And these were islands inhabited mostly by seabirds who had been there for so many years that the seabird manure was a couple of 100 feet thick on these islands. And since it didn't rain, it was protected against being leaching. And that product was known as guano. And it became such a craze in the 1800s that even the US Navy was patrolling the world's oceans to see if they could find islands that they could claim for the US that had similar seabird deposits on them. And yeah, that became enormous. But by 1870, these island deposits had been totally mined out. And that was about when the chemical fertilizer business really got rolling. And but then again, if you go back to 1842, when Liebig wrote his book, the book that inspired everybody to think that chemicals were the answer, when he wrote his book, people suddenly said, oh my gosh, we don't need all of these concerns we've been worrying about. We can just use chemicals. But it turned out that there were other farmers who were saying, well, wait a minute, these chemicals may have a temporarily quick effect, but it's organic matter in the soil that's going to keep things going forever and ever. And so, yeah, there was an interesting discussion going on for a number of years there. It didn't start in 1840. It started toward the end of the century. People were arguing about whether you needed the old-time techniques or whether these new fancy techniques would work. And there were a lot of farmers who never were convinced that the chemicals made sense, because they knew that the soil needed organic matter in order to be easy to work. And so they kept trying what I guess would call the early days of organic thinking. And I always want to say, lo and behold, it worked. It had always worked. That these techniques had been known since the beginning of agriculture.
Yeah, I was going to say, in ancient Mesopotamia, they didn't have a chemical fertilizer factory. So, and humans survived back then. Elliot Coleman, one of the things that you are really passionate about is the way in which the organic movement, the word organic, has been used and is being used today. If I walk into my local grocery store and I'm in the organic vegetable section, these may not be they may not be vegetables that are organic by your definition.
Yes, the USDA, Congress passed the Organic Standards Act, took control of organic farming. And I guess no one's allowed to use the word organic who isn't certified by them. But the tendency of a government bureaucracy is to listen to everybody and not just the people who they should be listening to. And so the USDA has been, I want to say seduced, maybe it is, seduced away from the original standards for organic by other interests. The worst of them is the interest in hydroponic growing. And the US is the only country in the world where hydroponic vegetables and fruits can be certified organic. And this has bothered a bunch of us old-time organic farmers greatly, because the public is being defrauded. You go into your local supermarket and go to the berry counter, and all of those blueberries, strawberries, raspberries, those are all hydroponic. Those are all coming from, if you see pictures of them, that no longer looks like a field. It's an area covered by all sorts of plastic tunnels that are filled with pots, and the pots have a little tube in there that's dripping nutrients into them. And even though they may be growing a blueberry bush in each of those pots, they are not in the soil, in the field, being grown in the way that everybody normally associates with organic. And so at the moment, if you want truly organic berries, go buy them from your local grower, because your local grower is the one who is still doing it the way it should be done.
Is the logic of the USDA that labels organic food organic, that organic means absence of pesticides and absence of chemical fertilizers? Is that what has come to define for many people what organic means?
Yes, except it's when you define something by the absence of, that's difficult. I'd like to define it by the presence of. And the way I define organic is by the presence of a biologically active fertile soil. And that is what the farmer is working with. And the farmer is adding organic matter to that soil, so all of the living creatures in there, and the soil is composed of ground rock particles, but it isn't soil until it has life in it. And the life in the soil is what's making everything work. And all the little creatures in there, and there are, you know, so many. When I first started, I was told there were 1 million live organisms in a teaspoon of fertile soil. And that's considered far too conservative today. There are so many, they're uncountable. And that is what is making a soil work on its own without my having to add nutrients to it. Because if I return organic matter to the soil, all those microorganisms and other creatures in there, their purpose in life is to break it down into nutrients for a new generation of plants. And yeah, that's when it works. So the USDA is stuck with a lot of these things that most laws are stuck with, that you can only legislate so much, and after a while it's going to be easy to sneak around it, and that's what they're experiencing at the moment. And so I work with a group of a bunch of old-time farmers like me, most of us are in our 80s, who know what organic means, and it means what you do, how you are treating your soil rather than what you don't do. And so the name of this group is the Real Organic Project. And we are battling with the USDA to try and get them to shape up their game. And there is so much money and power out there taking them in the other direction that it's been a frustrating experience.
We're speaking with renowned organic farmer and gardener, Elliot Coleman. I want to ask you, Elliot, about some of the things you've learned since you wrote your first book in 1989, some tips for farmers and gardeners throughout the state of Maine, but we do need to take a break. If you have questions for Elliot Coleman, we'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, my guest is Elliot Coleman. He has a new book out called The Self-Fed Farm and Garden. Elliot Coleman, one of the things you talk about is the difference between how you think about getting matter, getting products from outside of your farm now, and how it's different than when you first started. And you alluded to this a little bit before, but when you started Four Season Farm in Harborside, Maine, or even before that, when you had a farm before that, you were depending on your neighbors to help you amend the soil. Tell me about that, and then tell me a little bit about how your thinking has changed.
Oh, well, at the start, I live in an area where there were farms years ago, but they aren't operating now. They are all summer homes for out-of-staters. And they take good care of the place, and they pay someone with to come in with a bush hog once a year to mow the fields to keep up the farm look. And I'm a sneaky fellow. I would, when I chatted with these people, mentioned to them how dangerous it was to leave all that dry mown grass on the ground around their house, because they weren't collecting it. They were just mowing it and leaving it. And they would ask me to come and get it and take it away. And so we were able right from the start to get all sorts of organic materials, waste hay, that we could make compost out of and use to improve the soil here. And we, at the start, we had no money. We couldn't buy all those expensive things that are advertised in organic gardening, like dried blood and soybean meal and everything. And so we just used to round up whatever we could locally. And fortunately, it was all organic matter, and it was what the soil needed. And so that was how, from the start of this farm, and yeah, we had a long way to go, because I cleared this land here from spruce fir forest, which is, if you read anywhere about the type of land you want to clear to have a fertile soil, that wasn't what you wanted to do, but that was what we owned. We owned a piece of spruce fir forest, and we decided to turn it into a farm. And so there was a lot of time at the start to get enough organic matter in there to make everything work the way it should.
Mm. You talk about your farm even before that, though, that in which you, you know, you depended on local, you got manure from farm neighbors, and you got stone dust. It was this in New Hampshire or Vermont? I'm trying to remember.
In New Hampshire, when I... Yeah. First started farming, I was living in a rural village, and I just read about organic farming, decided I wanted to do it, and I had a lot of neighbors in a rural New Hampshire village who had piles of horse manure or chicken manure at their houses, and they were generous with it. They would say, yeah, come get a load of this or that. And that was how I began. And it was enough to make me realize that the concepts of organic farming were pretty darn solid. If I, as a total beginner, could just read what was being said, and it worked. And it worked fantastically. And so after my first year of experience growing plants, I just said, well, heck, I'm gonna go be an organic market gardener. And I did. And it has worked fantastically ever since then.
Your new book is, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, from the point of view of people out there, when Barbara and I did a TV show years ago, organic growing. One of the segments we did, we drove around the country finding free organic matter to bring home. And it was just amazing. If in some cases you had to call ahead and ask if the plant was open and you could come in and get crab shells or whatever it might be there. But we were able to bring home unbelievable quantities of useful organic materials to fertilize the soil.
Yeah. Your title of your book here is The Self-Fed Farm and Garden. And what you're talking about now is not getting organic matter from neighbors, but trying to be completely self-sufficient on the farm, which is really kind of, I think, a big jump, right? I mean, to say, I am going to be entirely self-sufficient. I'm going to make sure that this farm doesn't need anything from anybody. And that's the change in the last 30 years, right?
No, I'm glad you're asking that question. The self-fed farm doesn't mean it's never had things come in from outside, but they aren't purchased inputs. So if they are inputs that I can pick up for free, that's a thing. And back at the start, I can't turn history around. We were bringing all that stuff in before, and I mentioned in the book, toward the end of my early time here, we were buying composted cow manure from a local dairy farm. And it was the expense of that, $75 a yard delivered. And, you know, we live way out in the middle of nowhere. So there had to be all sorts of trucks and everything. And it was when I thought about that, I said, well, wait a minute. This is just organic matter. We grow organic matter. Farms grow organic matter. And there is a quote that I put at the beginning of the book here by an Irish farmer. It said, it should not be necessary to bring anything onto the farm from outside in the nature of manure or foodstuffs. That is the essential difference between a farm and a factory. And the beautiful thing about a farm, the extra organic matter I need to keep the soil fertile, I can grow it right here. And so I don't need to bring it in. But yes, the truth is when we started, we didn't know everything thing we know now. And we were following pretty general suggestions. And so, and I also mentioned that so many of the books that I was reading when I started being interested in this, the NPK concept had so taken over thinking that all the organic books were basically trying to figure out, oh my God, what can we recommend that isn't a chemical?
And NPK.
But would still work the same way that the NPK was going to work.
What and is so, that? Nitrogen, phosphorus?
And potassium.
Okay. Go on.
And so they were recommending that you use bone meal instead of superphosphate. Hey, that was all right, except unfortunately bone meal turned out to have a good bit of lead in it, and that wasn't nice. But the other people who understood the source of nutrients better were recommending phosphate rock, just a ground up natural rock, which is something we have used. And there were other suggestions like growing your nitrogen, so you didn't want to go get a soybean meal or something like that, because there's a really nice thing called a legume plant, and if you plant legumes, they can make an arrangement with bacteria to extract nitrogen from the soil and store it in little nodules on their roots. And this is the best possible way to get that nutrient. Sorry about that. And anyway, so this is all stuff that we have worked with over time. But what we are doing in now, and we're running a whole farm on just what we grow here, green manures. All of the inputs for soil fertility are being created right here. And I explained to people the nice thing about green manures, they keep working while I sleep. All the benefits they're bringing are right there in my farm fields without my going out and having to find them or buy them or deliver them. And so this is about as secure and independent a way to farm as anyone would want. And again, it isn't that this is awkward, because lots of the green manures we're using grow at times a year when we can't grow vegetables. So if we have overwintered green manures or ones that can be fit in into niches on either end of the main growing season. And they are so varied that they fit into almost any crop rotation you want to be running. So the more I thought about it, the more I said, well, this is a great solution. But mainly the book came about because so much of what I saw of organic out there was using purchased manure and purchased composts, and they were of suspicious provenance. They came with ingredients that you didn't want to have in the soil if you were growing food that you wanted to be as pure as possible. So when I first wrote about this, I wrote that I was interested in processes rather than products. And processes are things you do on the farm, like growing green manures or growing legumes and things like that. And products are all these fertilizers that people are buying. And these purchased composts and purchased municipal waste composts, I'm very suspicious of all of them, because one of the original suggestions to people, if they wanted to know if their compost was finished or not, was that when compost is finished, there's no way to distinguish what it looked like at the start. So you don't know what went into it. Well, if you buy compost today, and the people selling compost today are being paid to dispose of waste products, they're not being paid to produce a clean compost. Mm-hmm. And that has bothered me greatly.
Yeah, we're going to go to Rachel, who's calling from Freeport. Hi, Rachel. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. This is really just a thank you call to Elliot. I met him over 20 years ago when I was a student at the College of the Atlantic. And I had recently been introduced to organic agriculture, and I got to work with him one day on a farm. And I had the great opportunity to chat with him when we were done. And he had encouraged me to travel to Europe. There was this program called Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. And I think maybe his daughter had done it or he was familiar with it. And he said, if you want to learn organic agriculture, if you want to see a different way, go. And I did. I looked it up, I think, immediately that afternoon. And I went and spent years working on farms, learning that biodynamic agriculture, organic agriculture in Europe. And I really, to this day, 20 plus years later, I go back to that conversation and the impact Elliot had on my life that day working with him on the farm, and how I've incorporated into my life farming, gardening with my children, eating well, supporting local farmers. And I was so surprised to hear him on the radio today, because he's really crossed my mind numerous times that pivotal moment in my life talking to him and how it transformed really my whole path forward. So thank you, Elliot. I really appreciate the work you've done for Maine and for so many of us. And I just wanted to say thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. About the time I was teaching at your college, I was also running tours to take Americans over to see the European organic farms, because at that point they were way ahead of us, and we're doing things that we should have known about or needed to learn about. And those trips were eye-opening for me, because I'd first been there in 1974 at an international organic conference, and the improvements year after year were just incredibly impressive. And the thing about Europe never had a California like we had, and we just decided to heck with farming in New England, let's grow it all in California. But the Europeans, they were into local and a food grown by farmers who cared about the quality of it. And it was just a wonderfully different and exciting experience to get to know European organic farming. So I'm glad it was good for you too.
Rachel, thank you so much for calling. As we are speaking with organic farming expert and also author Elliot Coleman. He has a brand new book, The Self-Fed Farm and Garden. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to Maine Calling. Today we're talking about organic growing with none other than Elliot Coleman. He has a new book out. It is called The Self-Fed Farm and Garden. Its subtitle, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method. We'll go to John, who's calling from Gorham. Hi, John. What's your question for Elliot Coleman?
Well, I have a long history of pesticides in my body. It's a long story. However, how can somebody who wants to get involved in organic farming or using organic compost determine whether or not the pesticides have been used in the product? Is there any possible way of doing that? I see a lot of my neighbors with the little buckets that they're putting in their waste into, and a truck comes around and hauls it off to some location in Portland and makes compost. How is there any way to determine whether there's pesticides in compost?
Oh, well, great question. A lot of the materials that might be included in a municipal waste compost might come from the lawn care industry. And it turns out that there are herbicides that the lawn care industry uses that will go right through the most complicated composting processes. And so pesticides also, the idea to me when I first got into this, that intelligent human beings were spreading lead and arsenic on their food before they ate it. And that's because the original popular pesticides prior to Silent Spring was a product called lead arsenate. Now, if someone has put together a new chemical, maybe it will decompose. But lead and arsenic are elements, and they're going to be in your soil and in your body forever. And so just the initial poor thinking behind wanting to use pesticides, back when I knew nothing, that was enough to convince me there was something to this game.
Elliot Coleman, I think what John might be asking about is not municipal waste, but, you know, in the greater Portland area, and I know in other urban areas, there are these programs where people can put their food waste into a bucket, and then that's composted, and then they can get some of that compost back. Do you have more confidence in a program like that, or not really?
What I try and avoid on this farm is bringing anything in from outside if I don't know exactly where it came from. In fact, we have even stopped using the seaweed that we used for such a long time because there was an article in the Bangor Daily News about how the Indian tribes on the reservations north of Bangor have been told to stop eating fish from the river because there is a leaking landfill up there, leaking PFAS into the river. So these pesticide residues can come from almost anywhere. And I taught at a school in Vermont years ago. And when you were in the dining room, and the dining room was part of a dormitory, you could look out the window and see the pastures on where the animals were grazing. And under part of that pasture was the septic field for the dormitory. And it was so easy to take students over to the window and point out that if they put their nail polish remover or something like that down the sink in the dormitory, it was going to come up in the soil that their meat was being raised on. And in other words, there was no such place as a way mm-hmm. where you could throw things. And so if it's coming in from outside my farm, I just do not bother to use it.
John, thank you for your question. Elliot, we have so many questions coming in so little time. I'll try to get to a couple that are easy to answer.
Okay.
Kathy says, as I process my Brussels sprouts, I have this question. And she's asking, she says, she read a statement that said, do not remove legume roots, that the nitrogen fixed by the legumes remains in the root nodule and should be left in the soil for fertility in the next year. Is that true?
Yes. I mean, if you grow clover, you want to, if you're tilling, you want to till under the whole plant because that's the best way to improve your soil. Yes.
Okay. Selena's calling from Arundel. Hi, Selena. Go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Coleman. My question is, what do you think of the MAHA movement and Secretary Kennedy's initiative to make America healthy again?
Yes. When Kennedy first started making noise about Make America Healthy Again, an awful lot of us were hopeful that it would turn into something truly positive. And because I think his thinking may be a little twisted sometimes, or he isn't quite sure what he's trying to do, I don't think it is that way. So it would be wonderful if the MAHA movement was doing what we all hoped it would, but I don't think that is having any beneficial effect at the moment.
Selena, thanks for your question. We'll go out to Standish and Sherry. Hi, Sherry. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Thanks, Elliot, for being on the show. It's really beneficial. I was taking notes here, so that's great. So I was wondering what advice you would give to a small farmer or gardener in the face of climate instability. Are there any new approaches or, you know, greenhouse technology or anything like that that you're aware of that could help us with the, you know, droughts and the floods and things like that?
Oh, it's always a good idea to make provision for irrigating your crops on your property. So if you need water, you have it. As far as warming. One of the things we've specialized in from the start was how to grow crops in the winter without needing fuel to heat the greenhouses. And we found that by putting a layer of fabric inside the greenhouse over the crops, we were able to move them down to Georgia, basically, and they weren't in Maine anymore, and we could therefore grow a surprising number of semi-hardy crops all through the winter. As far as too much heat, whoa, that's a totally different game. If you build a greenhouse, you want to make sure you can ventilate it as thoroughly as possible.
Sherry, thanks for your question. We have two different emails asking you, Elliot Coleman, what you think of biodynamic gardening. Is that a term that you are familiar with, and or farming, biodynamic farming or gardening, and what do you think of it?
Yes, biodynamics came about from a series of lectures that the Austrian philosopher Rudolf Steiner gave back in 1924. And it is, let me figure out a way to put this, a more spiritually aligned way of thinking about growing vegetables than just pure organic. But even though it's using some of the same techniques, and some of the best farms I have ever seen in Europe were biodynamic farms, because they were paying such close attention to all of the things that a farmer needs to be on top of. So it is another way of doing organic. Well, I don't know, maybe biodynamic people will get mad at me for saying that, but it looks at the farm as a live organism in itself. And I think that's a delightful way to look at the farm. And and it's easy to understand once you start thinking that way whether you're doing it right.
Well, Elliot Coleman, I'm going to end with an email from Bruce, another thank you. He says, my dad was a biology teacher and a natural landscaper, and we always had composted going back prior to 1970. My wife and I were so lucky to have learned about Elliot and Barbara back in the TLC channel days after we moved to Maine. And then we got the books they wrote when we bought our first ancient farmhouse and started our vegetable gardens. We were very proud to have our organic veggies every year back then. We sold that place and don't have garden space, but we buy our veggies locally from small farms as much as we can. Our daughter has now bought an old farm in New Hampshire and is very active with her organic garden. Thank you for educating us all. And that's from Bruce. And just another voice of what your influence has been, Elliot Coleman.
Well, everybody always wants to come up and pat me on the back. The thing is, I've been having fun. This is what I enjoy doing more than anything else. So this is no great noble attempt to save the world. This is just Elliot looking at things from as much of a biological perspective as it's possible to look at them from.
Well, Elliot Coleman, thank you so much. Congratulations on your new book, The Self-Fed Farm and Garden. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.